My name is Steve, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have the lists of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Barbara will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Mary will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Mary and I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Anthony will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Anthony. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
We will try a four-month test format on anniversary night, which takes place on the last Tuesday of the month. As such, we will move the tradition speaker to the first Tuesday. The format of tonight's meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, one of which will speak on the fifth tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jim.
Evening, everyone. Jim, alcoholic. Wow. Okay, I'm either going to cry for 10 minutes, or I'm going to pass out or get sick or something. Let me see. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Nye. My sobriety date is May 20th, 2007. So I'm coming up on 3 years this month. I don't know. I stand before you today one of the most grateful human beings, and I think one of the luckiest people on the face of the earth. 3 years ago, I didn't want to wake up. Every morning, I would wake up and be like, "Ah, crap! I woke up again today." And it's just it blows my mind how grateful I am right now, right at this very moment, to be an alcoholic, to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just really blows my mind. I don't even know. I don't have the words to put in how grateful I am. But what it was like, it wasn't cute. At all. It was really ugly. I mean, I started drinking when I was 17. I had a lot of fun. I played football in college. Was like a starting offensive lineman for Division I school. You'd think that would make me happy. It didn't. I felt so uncomfortable in my skin. I remember being suicidal in fourth grade. I went from third grade to fourth grade. I was like this skinny blonde kid in third grade, and then all heck broke loose, and I got to be about this size when I was in sixth grade, so I was twice as big as everybody else. My mother made me take dance classes, ballet classes, because she heard football players needed to have coordination, because I was so uncoordinated. And I hated every aspect of my life. I hated the way I looked. I hated my size. I thought I had the worst family in the world. I thought we were the poorest people in the world. And that trend went on until I was 17 years old, and I remember those two cases of Bud Light that I got, and the first night I got drunk, I blacked out. But I remember taking that first drink, you know, that feeling of, it was like the first time I ever liked myself. Which is pretty sad when you think about it and what a horrible disease this really is. But that trend went on from the age of 17 to the age of 34. I chased after that feeling I had the first night I got drunk for 17 years of my life. I moved 56 times in 17 years, thinking the grass was always greener someplace else. I mean, I played football. The degree I got in college was to please other people. I was just an extremely unhappy human being. I would do things from, I mean, I would wake up and I would drive drunk all the time. I lost a car back in 1999 to DWI. I'm not losing the one I have now, I can clear that much. I would wake up in front of people's driveways with my car running and me passed out. Having wet my pants because I passed out in a blackout in front of somebody's driveway. I would work 80 hours a week, and if I wasn't working, I was drunk. And sometimes at work, I was drunk. I was a restaurant manager. It was part of the business. Everybody was drinking. So nobody ever really said to me, "Jim, you need to stop." Because I kind of kept it together. But in my own head, all I wanted to do was die. And it was pretty sad. And then I'd moved back from Raleigh, North Carolina. I mostly lived in the city and moved around Manhattan. But one of my stints was in Raleigh, North Carolina for 8 months. There was only so many margaritas by the pool you can drink, and I got bored. I came back to the city, got a job in the city, and I started dating this guy who's in the rooms. Wasn't then, and we kind of held each other hostage for a couple years. And if we weren't beating up each other and having the cops called. We were attacking other people. Both of us, and we were a pretty powerful couple. I mean, it's a kind of a scary, two like gay alcoholics that are kind of big going after everybody all the time is not, not a very spiritual path. So we dated for a while, broke up. I continued on my partying ways. And I don't remember about 9 years of my life. I was a blackout drinker. I started on Thursday night. It would end hopefully on Sunday afternoon some point, but I wouldn't remember much after that first couple hours of having fun at happy hour. The next 4 days would be a blur, and I wouldn't remember it. And I kind of figured it out one day. It was about 9 out of 17 years of drinking that I just don't remember. I mean, I woke up in North Carolina once, and I didn't remember where it was, or where I was. So anyways, we dated for a couple of years. I kept drinking, kept partying, kept chasing that, and my wanting to die every day just got worse and worse. I would end up at Queens World Plaza on the way home after going out for a night and deciding, all right, should I just jump in front of the train and get it done with? Just get it over with. What, you're so unhappy. You're miserable. I thought the entire world was out to get me. I thought every coach I ever had, every job I ever had, every friend I ever had didn't really like me. And I was miserable. Till, let's see, May 20th, 2007, I'd been on like a 4-day run with my friend Andrew, who I hadn't seen for 3 years, and then about a month ago, ran into him again, and he's 4 months sober. Which just proves to me that this works. It blows my mind. We went out. I was going to go out for one drink. Hit 13 gin and tonics in a half an hour. Ended up in Midtown, drank like a gallon of Jack Daniels. Drugs are a huge part of my story. Anything that I could take or do to keep me up longer, to maybe I might find some happiness somewhere, I would do. And like stuff that kept me, I was up like 8 months at one point, pretty much. When I first moved to New York, and I would look like a 250-pound crackhead is what I look like. Wasn't cute. But anyways, we went out that night. We had been out drinking. I was like an hour late for work the next day, feeling just that incomprehensible demoralization that we hear so much about in this room. And Roland walked into the gym that I was managing, Chelsea, and sat down with me and essentially said, Jim, you never have to feel the way you feel right now ever again in your life. He was a guy that I dated for a couple of years, and he had gotten a year of sobriety. And I saw him go from this insane, crazy person trying to do the same thing I was doing, find some happiness, into this sober man, which was, I was thinking, who are you? We had talked on the phone a few times, but we'd never hung out. So I said, yes. I don't know why. That goes against everything I ever want to do. And I remember thinking, how am I going to have fun anymore? Like that whole week leading up to my first meeting, I was like, what is this going to be like? I really didn't, I'd never even really heard of AA, didn't know what it was all about at all. So on that Friday, Roland took me to my first meeting. It was the Atlantic Group on the Upper West Side. And he sat with me on Broadway for about 2 hours and explained a lot of the stuff in here that scares the heck out of everybody. God. I still cringe a little bit when I say God. But he's there. I mean, I'm staying here sober almost 3 years. It has nothing to do with me. Explained just to kind of show up and do what I was told. And I've been going to meetings ever since. You know, to the Atlantic Group. I mean, if this is Andrew's first time here, and he's like, aren't you guys like the Branch Davidians? That's what everybody says, like you're some kind of cult or something like that. I don't know, kept me alive and sober for the past 3 years. When I wake up in the morning, I mean, this is what it's like today. Let me tell you what my day was like yesterday. I woke up, I hit my knees and prayed. Nah, I promise I did. Got up, got really nervous about speaking tonight when I was in the shower. I don't know why. Roland and I are like brothers now. He's literally like part of my family, so we hang out a lot. So I went and picked him up at his apartment yesterday. Went to my favorite restaurant up on 86 in York for lunch. We went and got manicures and pedicures. It's nice, right? But before we did that, we went and saved our seats at PAX, which is a men's meeting we go to every Monday night. Got our seats there, saw Andrew there as well, which still amazes me. And my heart goes a million miles an hour, man. When I see you in a meeting, when I think about that last night, what, are you kidding me? You know, I'm the guy who put the shotgun in his mouth after winning a Division I football game on ESPN, and in this huge game we would win. Every game I would go home, would get drunk, go home, put a gun in my mouth, and decide whether or not I was going to pull the trigger. And then I can have days like yesterday. I woke up in my own apartment that I only got because I'm sober. I got in my car that I only got because I was sober. I went and hung out with my brother, who I only have a relationship with because I'm sober. Was able to afford lunch only because I'm sober. Did the right decision, maybe went to a meeting. It's because I'm sober. That's because I have a connection with a higher power that's at work in my life. I have no idea what it is. I've stopped trying to figure it out. I just know that it works. I know that if I do it and I tells me, I know if I show up at meetings, I know if I be of service, I know if I help another alcoholic, like that's all I need to do. You know, I just got the 1 minute sign. But the one thing, I mean, all that stuff we hear in, I don't know if I have the right thing. Hold on. I lost it. All right, I lost where it was. Yeah, that's all right. So 9-step promises. They've come true in my life. And I still have no idea how this works. Like I said, I just show up and do what I'm told. It's not really that hard. Of course, for alcoholics, it is to show up and take direction from anybody. But once you start doing it, it becomes a habit. I'm telling you, man, my life right now is insane. Like, beyond my wildest dreams, like, the cash and prizes are Roland or Zach, Tammy, Tiffany, Nye, Peggy, the people in this room that I love so dearly in my heart that I know that I never had before, that I could call at any time of day. And if I need my life saved, they're going to help save my life. And that only came from being sober. So if you're new, coming back, stay. It works, please. So thank you for my sobriety.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Camille.
Hey, everyone. Excuse me. I'm Camille. I'm an alcoholic. So thanks, Jeff, for asking me to speak on the fifth tradition tonight. And here goes, 10 minutes. All right, so I will start with my stats, which is I'm an alcoholic. You heard that part. My sobriety date is March 12th, 2005. I have a sponsor. Her name's Debbie Y. Atlantic Group is my home group. Thank God. I love you guys. And I also have sponsees, and I do my best to work the steps every day. So tradition five, the short form, each group has but one primary purpose: to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The long form, tradition five, each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So many of you probably know this, but the history of the traditions is, you know, AA came about. They started to have groups, you know, it started to grow. And the first 10 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a lot of trial and error. There were a lot of turmoil and questions that came up. And taken from all of that, from living through that, Bill wrote the 12 traditions. And I don't know the exact date, but I think they came officially into fruition in 1950. But they were created 10 years after AA started. So I looked up some of the definitions for some of the words in the long form just to give me some clarity and to give me some depth to it. So it's each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought. Ought means duty or moral obligation, appropriateness, natural consequence. I like that part, natural consequence. So the natural consequence of each Alcoholics Anonymous group is to be a spiritual entity. Entity means essential nature or existence. So it's almost natural, right? We're like naturally a spiritual existence. We're naturally a spiritual entity. I see it. I knew it the minute I came into AA. You know, like, these people seem a little crazy, but there's something here beyond that, you know? I could feel it, you know, even if it was just a tiny bit. And, then primary, so each entity having but one primary purpose, primary first or highest in rank or importance. So this is our first, the most important purpose. Our primary purpose is that of carrying its message, the group's message, to the alcoholic who still suffers. Carry is to transfer from one place to another. It's an action word. We're carrying it. We're not just sitting there waiting for you guys to come get it. We carry it, right? The message, what is the message? It's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was doing research, some people said the message is hope. That's it. It's just hope. It's pretty beautiful. I mean, like, I get tears, you know, I get choked up just thinking about that, like, hope, really? Because when I was out there, I didn't have any hope, you know? And like I said, even the first meeting I came to, I could feel that hope. I could only feel it a little bit, but it was there, you know? So it's important. This is important. We're going to carry this message of hope. We're going to carry the message of the 12 steps of recovery, of sobriety. One of the other speakers that I listened to when I was doing research for this said that the message is sobriety. And then I looked up the word suffers. So carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So what does suffers mean, right? To undergo or feel pain, distress, injury, loss, anything unpleasant. So that's probably all of us, right? I mean, and that's okay. That's life on life's terms. What is that? I'm not one of these people like, oh, we're here to suffer, you know, but it happens. That's life. And it's not just because I have 5 years of sobriety doesn't mean that I don't suffer sometimes. And everyone in this room should know that, especially the newcomer, you know, it's not like, oh, all of a sudden I arrive at some perfect place. It's a daily reprieve, which is beautiful, because the beautiful thing is that means we all get to help each other. It's not like I graduate and then you guys are kind of dumb, but I'll help you, you know, if you really need it and I feel like it, if I'm not too busy, you know what I mean? And it's not like that. It's like I need every one of you in this room for my sobriety. I need to be able to carry a message and to share that common solution with you. That's how I stay sober. That's how we all stay sober. It's amazing. So the tradition also doesn't say that others have to believe it or want it. So it doesn't matter if someone believes what I'm carrying or wants it. I get to share it anyway. And another guy that I was listening to, he was an old-timer that was around the same time as Bill, and he said that in this tradition, we're not talking about anyone but alcoholics. So it says we're carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, it doesn't mean I can't help other people or that I can't be of service. You know, we practice these principles in all our affairs, but this tradition is talking about the group and how are we going to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So Atlantic Group, you know, takes a lot of meetings to institutions and jails. That's one of the ways the Atlantic Group carries the message. I know that we have outgoing speaker commitment. You can talk to, I think it's Nicole or Joel, like those people, and we can go to other groups and carry the message that way, carry our message as Atlantic Group. So to go to the 12 and 12, the 12 and 12 starts out when they're talking about the fifth tradition, shoemakers stick to thy last. So it's like, you know, I wasn't even sure what last meant. I kind of had an idea, like, oh, I think it's that, you know, a piece of the shoe or something. And I looked it up, and it's the holding device shaped like a human foot that is used to fashion or repair shoes. So if I'm a shoemaker, I'm going to stick to this device that's shaped like the foot, like I'm making a shoe for the foot, right? So why wouldn't it be in the shape of the foot? And if I don't stick to that, I mean, I was just thinking, like, what if he used a shape like a balloon, you know, like, I mean, you know, like, hey, shoemaker, my shoes feel weird, you know, it's like, these aren't working, like, just wear them, they're hot, you know, I don't know, it's like, I don't really, you know, thank God being hot isn't my primary purpose anymore, you know, like, that was my primary purpose for a long time, like, how can I be the hottest? But it's, you know, I'm just trying to make the point that it's, you know, we get to come in here and we have another primary purpose. And, you know, it's funny to think about, like, what if the shoemaker didn't use that device? So that's what they're saying, you know, they're talking about, please stick to what you're good at and what we do the best. And that we can help problem drinkers as others seldom can. We pass one idea, And that idea is sobriety, which means soundness of mind, freedom, reasonableness, and steadiness. Those are some of the definitions of sobriety. And there was one other thing I wanted to read from AA Comes of Age. It's on page 106. And they're talking about the idea of, you know, we do this. Why do we follow the traditions? We do it because otherwise we're going to die. And, I mean, that's great. You know, we're either going to die spiritually or we're really going to die literally, physically. But this is not the whole story. This is what it says. As our individual and group development progresses, we begin to obey the AA traditions for other reasons. We begin to obey them because we think they are right for us. We obey these principles because we think they are good principles, even though we still resist somewhat. Then comes the final level of obedience, the best of all. We obey AA's steps and traditions because we really want them for ourselves. It is no longer a question of good or evil. We conform because we genuinely want to conform. Such is our process of growth in unity and in function. Such is the evidence of God's grace and love among us. And, you know, I'm not always there every day, but I have had that experience of wanting, you know, like, oh, the traditions, wow, they're kind of interesting, you know? Like, my first couple of years of sobriety, I didn't care. Like, it was so boring, and, like, why is anyone even talking about that? It's creepy. Don't tell me what to do, you know? Like, I've always been told what to do. God forbid someone's telling me what to do again. And now I see them as a, you know, it's a key to freedom for me and for all of us. And it also keeps AA alive. It's so important, you know, like without AA, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't feel as free as I do. Like alcohol helped me feel free for a while, but, you know, it stopped working. And I needed a bigger and better solution. And I found it here in AA, thank God. And you know, all of us have, I mean, all of us are carrying the message today just by being here right now. Like, you've got to have some kind of hope just to be in this room, you know, just like maybe there's another way. Maybe I don't have to continue on the way I did. Maybe I don't always have to feel like this, or maybe there is a solution, you know, and I'm just so grateful for this group and all the service that it does, and all that I've learned here about showing up and being part of a group and having unity and not just thinking about myself all the time. And I'm just really grateful for the tradition, so thanks you guys so much.
Our main speaker tonight is Leslie.
Hey everybody, my name is Leslie, I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Jeff for asking me to come and share my experience, my strength, my hope. I'm not from New York. I'm here working for 2 or 3 months. I'm on the road about 8 months out of the year with my job, so I always drop anchor, whatever city I'm in. So what a better way to drop anchor. So I want to welcome, I was just amazed at how many people counting days. That's just wonderful. I mean, that's why I'm here. That's why most of us are here. And I want to give you a little bit of advice that was handed to me. My sobriety date is October 20th, 1997. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked around, and I thought, so it's come to this. I was 42 years old, and, you know, I just thought it's interesting. I remember I thought that my sobriety, I thought, you know what, it'll be like taking the veil. I'll just be like a monk, you know, like a nun, and I'll live very quietly with my little big book, and it'll be very austere, and I'll go quiet, placidly amidst the haste, and it's nothing like that. I have 12 years of sobriety, and anyway, we'll get to that in a little bit. But for the new person, I would like to make a promise to you that I heard that really meant a lot to me. And I can promise you that the obsession to drink alcohol will be removed. It took a long time, you know, for me. It took a full year. I still have a very healthy respect for it. But it took a full year before, on a daily basis, I did not think about drinking. There was a wonderful lady. I love the old broads. There's a lot of old broads here in AA, you know. I love that because let me tell you something about the old broads in AA. You cannot charm them, you know. if you were the kind of alcoholic I was, you learned, we're charming people, you know, and you get into these rooms and you cannot charm, you know, they could care less that you once guest starred on Murphy Brown, you know, they, it means nothing to them. So I, this wonderful lady named Miss Jane Gray, who we lost this year with many, many years of sobriety, came up to me and she could see, I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was physically very sick. You know, I had been drinking and doing drugs for so many years. My synapses weren't firing correctly. I couldn't think. And I don't think we talk enough around Alcoholics Anonymous about how long it takes just to get physically sober, just to where you can put thoughts together. And people were laughing at things that I didn't think were funny and seemed very clicky to me. And it reminded me of Sunday school. That was just the worst thing. Most of all, I knew that because I was 42 years old that this was it, you know. I didn't have another go in me, period. And so I was done, and I wanted to do this right, but I couldn't. I was just overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed. Miss Jane Gray came up, and this is what I would like to say to all our new friends that are counting days. The only thing for our friend with one day that I think you need to worry about is do not leave this meeting tonight without knowing when your next meeting is. Therefore, there's two things you need to leave here with. A book, because it'll be a wonderful, early in sobriety, it's a wonderful sleeping aid. You know, I suggest We Agnostics. Oh, it'll put you right out. You know, the further along you get, you're going to realize the beauty of that book. But early on, those first 165 pages, which is what we suggest you read, will just put you right out. And I had not slept for years. And so, so you want to leave here with that, and you also want to leave here with a meeting directory. And just do not leave this meeting without knowing when your next meeting is. And if you see a friendly face, maybe ask them, you know, where do you go on Wednesday, or where do you go later on tonight? And then between now and that next meeting, just do your best. You know, do your best to not drink. And that's what you will slowly, from October 20th, 1997, you know, because you hear things, you know, sponsorship and this and that, and I want to do the right thing. And Jane Gray said, breathe, honey, breathe. Just breathe and don't leave here without knowing when your next meeting is. Because if you're in these rooms, it will happen, you know. We suggest the 90 meetings in 90 days, but that's the best advice that you're going to get is 90 meetings in 90 days. Now, I grew up in the Deep South. I don't know what your first clue would have been, but I sort of fell out of the womb and I landed in my mother's high heels, and I was just. My daddy was a lieutenant colonel in the Army, and I was not exactly the son that he envisioned. My dad used to call me son as if he was in deep pain. You know, it was just like, oh, son. Because my mother, my sweet mother, Miss Peggy Ann, and my maternal grandmother, Miss Mary Lucille, took one look at little Leslie, and I guess they thought, oh, he's going to need some help. And they circled the wagons, as only good Southern women can do. And they created this amazing little secret garden where it was okay for little boys to play with dolls. It was okay for little boys to read Trixie Belden and Nancy Drew instead of those rambunctious, hardy boys. It was okay for little boys to sew doll clothes and make pot holders. It was okay for this little boy to do whatever he wanted except, shh, shh, shh. No, honey, let's don't show daddy. You know, so you hear so much around these rooms about shame. You know, I just fell out of the womb ashamed. You know, there was just something really wrong with Leslie. And you know, my dad was killed in a plane crash when I was 11, which is a horrible time for a boy to lose his dad. But I knew when my dad's plane went down, I was 11 years old, I knew to the core of my being that he went to his grave a little ashamed to have a son like me, and I didn't even know what like me meant, you know? And I remember I was 14 years old, and we were devout Southern Baptist. And by the time I was 14, I had been baptized 13 times. You know, I don't know if you know anything about the Baptist church, but you come forward and make a public profession of your faith, and then you're baptized, and then you're saved forever, you know? But the preacher would say, come forward, lost sinner. And I had this huge secret. I think, oh, boy, that's me, you know? So I would go forward. My mother would say, son, you're already saved. Remain seated. But I could not. And we don't, I saw something. They sprinkle here. See, we dunk, honey. We dunk. You know, I've been baptized in creeks and swimming pools. I've been baptized everywhere you could possibly get baptized. But you could not wash me clean, you know. And I remember as a kid thinking to myself, if I can get out of the hills of Tennessee, you know, if I can get away from this church, you know, these people that I didn't think embraced me. And oh, by the way, one thing that I have learned in sobriety is that I honor the sanctity of all religions. If you're on a spiritual path, I don't mean, and especially if the Baptist is your spiritual path, I know that so many people get sober and return, you know, to the temples and their churches and this. I don't mean to make fun, you know, I really don't. But I honor the sanctity of all religions. The only religion that I personally embrace is a religion of kindness, the religion of love, the religion of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, this is where I come, you know, for my spiritual food. But where was I? What were we talking about? So I remember when I was a kid thinking, if I can get out of here, if I can find people like me, I'm going to be okay. Well, in all my travels, I finally land in West Hollywood, California. There's queers hanging from the trees, you know, and I think the loneliest I have ever been is sitting in the Gold Coast, a gay bar on Santa Monica Boulevard, coming off a six-day run, you know, just trying to drink, sitting there and surrounded by people like me. I think it's the loneliest I've ever been. And it was not until I was 42 years of age and that I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I began to hear the music, which took me a while, I think I exhaled for the first time in my life. Because what a realization that my messed up life had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that I grew up homosexual in the hills of Tennessee with a father that I didn't feel embraced me, with a religion that I didn't feel embraced me. I'm an alcoholic, and there is a solution. And what was wonderful about it, for our new friends, we do what's called a fourth step, which is a searching and fearless moral inventory, which basically is just to get rid of all that baggage that you have hauled for years and years and years from childhood. I did my fourth step, and my sponsor looked at me, and he said, you know, Leslie, it seems to me that your greatest fear in life is heterosexual men. And I said, well, it wasn't exactly a picnic on the playground. I mean, you know, I don't know if you remember dodgeball, but I do, you know. Smear the queer. Boom. And I had to tap dance or get creamed. Yeah, you know. And my sponsor said to me, he said, you know, Leslie, in recovery, we don't go over our fears. We don't go under our fears. We don't go around our fears. We work through our fears. And I want you to join an all-male, all-stag recovery group. I really thought I was going to faint. I mean, I said to him, you know, when I asked you to sponsor me, you said to me, was I willing to go to any lengths? But I am telling you, I'm very fragile right now. And I was, you know. And I don't know if I can walk into a room filled with masculine, big, heterosexual guys and divulge my innermost secrets. I'm not sure it's a good idea, you know. And he said, I suggest that you join an all-male, all-stag recovery group. I walked into Radford Hall on a Monday night, which is in Studio City, California. You could have cut the testosterone with a knife. There were about 100. Listen, they don't sing happy birthday to celebrate someone's sober recovery. They do, what's the football? A huddle. They get in the huddle. Seriously. And they go, ooh, 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 ooh. Ooh, ooh. To celebrate people's birthday. And I walked into this room with about 100 of these guys. And it's that kind of masculinity that my dad had. It's this, it's an easy kind of masculinity that terrifies me. I'm real attracted to it, but we're not going to go down that road. We ain't going down that road. But I'm terrified of it. And I walked in, and my first thought as I walked into this all-male stag was, oh, my God, I should have left my what we call our male purse. I mean, straight guys carry bags, but it's something the way that a gay man could carry that makes it a merce. And as if, had I left that in the car, none would have been the wiser, you know. That would have been the only thing gave me away. But I walked in with this bag, you know, and I was so nervous, and early in my sobriety, I shook. I shook for a full year, and it was so embarrassing. I don't know. My synapses weren't firing. My blood sugar was awry. They used to call me the little chihuahua. That was in my gay group. But anyway, so I walked in, and I sat down, and I remember I just took the side of the chair and held it because I was so embarrassed of the way I shook. And we went around the room. This was the kind of meeting where we go around the room and everyone, you know, introduces themselves. And I used to have this thing I would try. Like, there's a certain way that really masculine straight guys in the Deep South where I come from, I think it has to do with tobacco. I'm not sure, because they kind of don't move their lips. And so they got to me, and I was sort of, you know, well, my name is Leslie, and I'm alcohol. They were on to me, you know. But near the end of the meeting, the leader said, would our new friend, and it was a podium share, you know, you had to go up some steps to the podium, which, you know, if you're new, you can imagine if I called you up here right now how frightening that would be. But this guy said, would our new friend like to come up and say hello and share with us tonight? And all I could think about was, in my gay recovery group, this guy told a story. He was a real sissy. I mean, he kind of made me look like a Hell's Angel, this guy. He called his sponsor and he said, I have to go tell my story to a group of primarily straight people, and I'm just really nervous. Do you think I should tell them right off the bat that I'm gay? His sponsor goes, honey, you got to walk to the podium. They're going to know. So I was so nervous, but, you know, I probably had 60 days of sobriety, and I got to the podium. And I looked out over this sea of heterosexual men, which to me was like the enemy. It was my dad, you know, my dad and his army buddies. But something very cathartic happened. I instinctively knew that this was the jumping off point. And it reminded me of when I was a kid, there was a high diving board at the public swimming pool. And none of the kids had any problems. And I was so scared to go up that ladder and jump off, because my fear was that I would get up on the board, which was really high, and too scared to jump, and then you have to, like, back down the ladder, make all the kids, you know. But I remember I stood there and I thought, this is do or die. This is sink or swim. And I took a deep breath and I said, my name is Leslie. I'm a alcoholic. I'm also a recovering drug addict. But there's something that I think I need to say out loud in front of you men for my sobriety, and that is that I'm a homosexual. And I was waiting, like, for this one, you know, the smart aleck in the back. No, shit. No, wait a minute. Anyway, but it's like everybody forgot to breathe. And I forged on. I said, I am scared to death of you men. My daddy was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. He was killed in a plane crash when I was 11. I've spent most of my life feeling like I did not measure up. And I'm afraid you're going to be disgusted by me. I'm afraid you're going to laugh at me behind my back. But most of all, I'm afraid you're going to shun me. And I was given directions to join this group. And I am too scared right now to not take directions. And I think at 42 years of age, for the first time in my life, because I'll tell you, I'm a liar. I've been a liar my whole life. I told the truth. And the unconditional love that those sober men extended, I became a part of something really, really important that night. I never missed a meeting for 4 years. I was sort of like the meeting mascot, you know. Our little queer. Have you met him? Yeah, we got a queer. But I'll tell you what happened that I did not expect. This is not what I walked on October 20th, 1997. I did not walk into these rooms to take the journey that I have taken. Because I have to tell you, with 12 years of sobriety, my journey, now this is just my journey into sobriety has been an amazing journey into my queerdom, where I stand before you closer to my authentic self than I have ever been. And I am, you know, these men began to take me through the steps with my sponsor, and we talk a lot about working the steps. They taught me to live the steps. That there was no problem that could come my way that we couldn't sit and figure out a plan. And so they gave me something I didn't even know I didn't have, a code in which to live my life by. I had good parents. They taught me right from wrong. They didn't raise me to be a liar. They didn't raise me to be a thief. They didn't raise me to be sexually promiscuous. They didn't raise me to be sexually perverted, whatever that is. They didn't raise me, you know, this is where my disease took me. And somewhere along the line, I was just floundering. And it's almost like I'd been in a weird holding pattern since I was 11 years old. Because I don't think that we raise little boys. I'm not quite sure what we do wrong. But there, I went to see this musical one time where it was called Legally Blonde, and there was a song: "Is he gay or just European?" And I thought, I sat there and I thought, you know, that's heavy. And I'll tell you why: because maybe in Europe they don't shove that masculine kind of thing, so a little boy can cross his legs. I can remember my dad telling me, "Don't sit like that," you know, "Don't sit like that," and so. In the shame of all of that somehow, and I had figured out the first time I drank, you know, when I was 14 years old, was when that sort of, all that shame went away. So I'm 42 years old, and these men taught me that it matters not one iota that I never learned to walk or to talk like a man. Because, see, I had this mistaken idea that it had to do with how much weight you could lift or how far you could throw that football or how many women you've bedded or things I'll just go to my grave a dismal failure at. They said, no, as long as I remain true to my code, I am a man. And that is the greatest gift, you know, that I could ever have been given, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. Newcomer, you're not even going to realize, like, it's going to have to be almost pointed out to you, because we don't really know our own progress. I was 11 years sober, and I told my mother when I was 12 years old that I thought I was homosexual. They took me to therapists. You know, as my sponsor said, she did the best she could with the light she had to see with, and I loved that. But, you know, it was the 1950s in the hills of Tennessee, and your sons told you. So over the years, my mother and I have developed this sort of amazing don't ask, don't tell, you know. I had this boyfriend one time, 6'4", mother called him my little friend. How's your little friend? What are you and your little friend going to do for Thanksgiving? But my mother also... I would bring her to Los Angeles where I live, and we would be eating, and here I would be a 40-year-old man, you know, this is before I got sober, and some screaming friend of mine would come running over to the table. Hey, girl, how you doing? And I'm like, I'm with my mother. Quit talking like that. You know, I had these, like, I invited my mother. I do, I entertain on cruise ships. And so I did this cruise to Alaska, and I invited, they said to me, there's an extra stateroom. And without thinking it through, I invited my mother on a cruise with 2,000 gay men. Now, when it hit home was when I'm in Los Angeles, she's in Chattanooga, but we're meeting in Seattle, but they sent us the itinerary of the ship. Well, there was leather night, and then there was underwear night, and there was all the, my phone rang, and my mom said, well, I'll tell you what I'm not going to do, and I thought, oh, gosh. She said, I'm not going to go ice fishing. So, but what was interesting was, This group of men on this ship enveloped my mother, and she became the queen of the ship. And I realized that because of the work that I have done in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am an authentic person with you, with you, with you. It doesn't matter. I am who I am, you know. One of those men in my meeting gave me a card, the one I was most scared of, this big, big, butch guy, who, by the way, told my story. Newcomer, you're going to hear your story from this guy, a heterosexual guy from Brooklyn, told my story and talked about where the broken toys in the next room, you know, that have been tossed aside. Anyway, just told my story. He was the one I was most afraid of. He came up to me and he had laminated a card to go in my wallet. And on the card, he said, I think you need to carry this with you. And on the card it said, what you think of me is none of my business. And I thought, wow, I've spent my whole life, you know. I wish that I could sit down with each of our new friends that are here tonight and say, you know, get sober and you can win an Emmy. Well, I just got that in. I'm so sorry. Never mind. But anyway, I wish that I could say, because I am an alcoholic who got some cash and got some prizes, but I tell you what, I don't believe in the devil, because I was raised, you know, to scared to death of that, with the red horns and down in that fire, and I was an imaginative child, but if there was a devil and he was standing right here and said, okay, look, you can have the cash and the prizes, but what you cannot have is that. I loved his speech about what he did, Jim, what he did for the day, you know, just an amazing, quiet kind of, my life is just, it's like this revolving vortex around me, and I'm in the middle of it, and it's all gravy, you know. I'm just having the time of my life, and thank God I have this program. But I would like to sit with each of our new friends and tell you, you know, stick with us. And you're, the only thing, as we read earlier, was the only thing that we can promise you is a daily reprieve that is contingent upon your spiritual maintenance. But what we can offer you, I think I can tell you that if you don't stick with us, none of your dreams will come true. I think that's a given. You know, I think you know that. So what we can offer is we sort of even the playing field for people like us, you know, that lost it all. You know, we even that playing field so you can springboard towards your dreams. I want to finish with a story. When I walked in here and I heard the word God, I consider myself spiritually damaged, because I think things that happened to me when I was a kid, like I think to tell a little boy about a red man with horns deep within the earth, especially a little boy that fell out of the womb and landed in his mother's high heels, I think that's spiritual abuse. You know, and I hear so many people around the room say, well, I didn't grow up with a lot of, you know, religion. And I think, honey, you're so ahead of me. What I had to go through just to discard, to find some sort of loving God. And do you know that I had, before I got sober, I had a true religious experience. When I was a little boy, the two little queers in my Sunday school class found each other. I just thought that was so amazing, the two little boys. And we would go, I had the perfect mother for a gay son, because she had falls and all this stuff. And my little friend, we didn't know what drag queens were or anything, but we'd go dress up in my mother's clothes and pretend like we were Diana Ross and the Supremes. And then we grew older and never mentioned that shameful thing, just shameful. So he took a much different path than I did. He got married. And then he was married for a while, and he got a divorce, and I bump into him 20 years later in the middle of West Hollywood, California. And I said, "Where have you been?" He said, "Honey, I've been having a homo hoedown." And so, but my friend, this would have been 1982, my friend was the very first person that I knew to be diagnosed with the AIDS virus, and it was terrifying. Back then, if you visited someone in the hospital with the, you had to wear an entire space suit. Now, I was so into my disease and so, I don't know, I was fearless. And I would sit with him night after night after night. I'd let him smoke cigarettes. He was on oxygen. You know, we could have blown the place sky high. I would let him, anyway, one night about 5 o'clock in the morning, he had fallen asleep and he bolted up out of his sleep, and he said to me, "Leslie, do you think I'm being punished?" And I said, "You know what? You're ruining my high." I'm ruining my... No, I said, we're not too selfish, are we? But I told him, "Look, you know, they're leaning toward that it's a virus, you know, that it's this is not a moral issue." But he became like a parrot, you know. "Do you think I'm being punished? Do you think I'm being punished?" Over and over and over. 3 days before he died, he sat up and he was as lucid as I ever saw him. Now, after this happened, even in the throes of my disease, I knew about being of loving service to others, and I would work with hospices and things. And I have to tell you that I have found that when someone gets near the end of life's journey, telephone lines go up. When someone gets near the end of life's journey, they become bathed in some... I've seen miracle. I've seen amazing things. But my friend bolted up in bed and he said, "The most amazing thing has happened, Leslie. I prayed last night. I haven't prayed since I was a kid. I prayed and God spoke to me." And, you know, I was so into my disease. I was like, "Oh, that's just wonderful. What? I can't wait to hear what he said." People wondered why I could sit with him all night long. Well, they didn't know what I had in the bathroom, but... Anyway, he said, he took my hand with, and this was a West Hollywood party boy, this was not a very deep thinker, and he said to me, "You know, Leslie, I heard him. I heard him with these ears, in this body, on this plane of existence. I heard the voice of God, and it's so simple. You see, the soul has no gender. So when it's all said and done, it's not whom one loved that's important. What's important is the quality of the love. We are on this earth for one reason and one reason only, and that is to give quality love on a daily basis." Now, I was 4 years sober before any of that began to resonate to me. And all this struggle, you know, and yet I still, I'll have to tell you, newcomer, I get up on many, many mornings and I say my third step prayer to the wall, but I seek. And what I seek is a God that does not do for me or to me. He only shines through me. That I can work with. Thank you so much for letting me share.